Thanks everybody for coming. I will also say I have a surprising number of former and present students who have come, and since they're the only people who've seen me lecture at the Blackboard before, I guess maybe this won't be as terrible as I had imagined, but we'll see. So when I thought about, I was trying to think about our program in the context of what I would have found interesting as a when I was a physics grad student, and you know, boundary layers for us mean something very specific. And I wanted to give you a sense of what that means in this broader context of how the Earth system works, and give you a little bit of a hint of how we think about, or at least how I think about, different hunks of the Earth system and how they're operating together. And so why are boundary layers special? Because they break a lot of the behaviors that are common not in the boundary layers, so in the free troposphere or in the ocean interior. And so we'll get a flavor of a few of the dynamics, the geophysical fluid dynamics, which is typically what we call it, but it's really rotating stratified fluid dynamics. So I'll give you a little bit of the sense of how that feels, a little bit of how our system works in terms of where the energy goes and where the energy needs to get transported around. And then I'll give you just a light touch on how boundary layers break those large-scale rotating stratified pieces, and why that's a subject that's exciting when we put it back in the context of the Earth system, which is what we're trying to do. So here's the Earth system, or here's the Earth, with a continent covering, you know, about a third, oceans covering the rest, clouds, especially in the intertropical convergence zone, and then ice at the poles. And then there's the sun, which is very far away in this compression on the board. And then I have put some sort of obscure pieces of the radiative balance of the Earth down here, but I want to walk through how that works, because you'll start to see how it connects to the other pieces as we go along and why the boundary layers play an important role. So incoming sunlight comes in relatively short wave, you know, visible wavelengths. Some of it bounces off the surface. A lot more of it bounces off of clouds. And so the numbers here are, we get about 341.3 watts per meter squared coming in from the sun, of which about a third of it bounces back out. The albedo is that, and then the rest of it is getting absorbed, and of the part that's bouncing back out, the vast majority of it is coming off of clouds. Okay, so the clouds are a big part of the system. We'll come back to that. So how does the rest of the radiation get, how do we get an energy balance? We're not just getting heated and heated and heated. Well, once this sunlight gets absorbed, and whether it's getting absorbed by the atmosphere or by the clouds or by the surface, that's a big part of figuring out the energy budget of the Earth. But we know that all of those things will re-emit infrared radiation based on their temperature. And so we have outgoing long-wave radiation. I'll draw in red because it's infrared. And that's about 238.5 watts per meter squared. So we have 342 coming in, 238 going out, about a third of it bouncing off. In, let's see, the middle of last decade, there was about a 1 watt per meter square imbalance. This, you basically, yeah, so it's complicated because it is also a function of space and what's emitting. So the this is measured by satellite at the top of atmosphere, and this is incoming and outgoing. It's also measured by satellite. So these are top of atmosphere numbers. Actually, among the biggest long wave is up and down. It goes back and forth at about double this magnitude. Back and forth between the clouds and the atmosphere absorbing and re-emitting back down, and up and down and up and down and up and down. So if you stand on the surface and measure the upward radiation, you get a much bigger number than this. And the downward would also be a bigger number than this. Those two cancel out.
Just to have an idea of the in the last glaciation age or whatever, when there was how much the albedo changed?
Oh,
this fraction, a small fraction or a big fraction?
A fairly large fraction, because ice is really quite bright, like 0.8. And so if you cover a substantial fraction of the Earth with a 0.8, it gives you a lot. And sea ice versus ocean is a really big switch, because ocean is quite a bit smaller than this, like 0.2, 0.1, depending on angle of incidence. And so when you cover the oceans with sea ice, you also get a big feedback. So it is a pretty substantial change. Although I don't think it went past a half. I think it's, you know, kind of back and forth in that territory. We don't... I mean, you could actually... The right way to do it would be to infer it from a radiated temperature, probably, and then to guess what the albedo had to be consistent with that. So the surface temperature is around 288 Kelvin. But to get this much stuff going out, you need a number around 255 Kelvin. So you can immediately read something off of that, maybe. You can say, well, the spots that are emitting are colder than the surface. If you want to think of it as a pure black body, and that's not a terrible thing to think about. A lot of the emissions are coming from the poles, which are just colder because they're the poles. A lot of them are coming from aloft, which are colder because they are aloft in the atmosphere. So the cloud top brightness is one way to think of this, or also polar regions are emitting more than in this net balance than the tropics. Yeah?
The solar constant is 1,300 watts per square meter.
Yes. So this is an average over the diurnal cycle and seasonal cycle, and it's only in the normal direction, so there's a projection that gives you a factor of 4.
Day-night?
Yeah.
Average? Okay.
Yeah. Day-night average. Absolutely. Yeah. So this is average to the surface over both the night side and the day side. And it's got this isn't a disk, it's a sphere, so it's got the normal projection part too. Okay, so, and that's what I want to say about this. Okay, so, all right, that's lovely, except the sun doesn't shine the same strength everywhere on the Earth. It shines more at the equator than it does at the poles. So how does that work? So we've got more energy coming in here and then up there. And obviously daytime versus nighttime too, but that change kind of averages out as we spin around underneath. The pole versus equator doesn't necessarily. So it turns out that there is an excess of energy arriving here compared to the outgoing long wave that departs from the tropics. And near the poles, there is more outgoing than incoming, to the tune of about 100 watts per meter squared difference. So there's about 100 watts per meter squared more going out at the poles than coming in. And there's about 100 watts per meter squared more coming in than going out at the tropics. So what happens? Anybody? How do we balance that energy budget? Any guesses?
Ocean.
Yeah, convection, ocean, there we go. So the atmosphere and the ocean both conspire to move energy away from the tropics and toward the poles. And it's a little more complicated because they really do it in a seasonal way. So they're really kind of only going one way, not both ways, with equal strength. But for the moment, we can just take the multi-year average, and it's going from the tropics out to the poles. And that number is about 5 times 10 to the 15 watts going petawatts. So about 5 petawatts going. And of that, about a third is carried by the oceans. A third is carried by sensible heat in the atmosphere, so hot air going away from the tropics toward the poles. And a third is in latent heat, so moist air going towards the poles, dry air coming back. Dry air and seawater coming back. Okay? So that's roughly how the system works. So you might wonder a little more about that mechanism. It is kind of a convective process, but it's not really a convective process because it's sideways. But it is convective in the sense that the atmosphere is heated from below. It's heated both by the surfaces getting warm and then warming the atmosphere from below, but also because the absorption of radiation isn't uniform throughout the atmosphere, so You end up heating the atmosphere from below, it rises.
In some circles, convection is a synonym for advection.
That's true. I'm being a little bit more explicit because I'm going to come back to convection in a moment. So, heating below by the sun, and so the atmosphere is like a heat engine. It's getting heated at high pressure and cooled at low pressure. Heated at high pressure, cooled at low pressure. Its outgoing is at lower pressure, so it's like a heat engine. Yeah.
Is there a reason that there's roughly equal energy carried in the ocean and the atmosphere?
No, and it's not quite precisely equal. It's and it's a really interesting question, way beyond the scope. What happens during glaciations? Whether it changes or whether it stays the same balance? Yeah, it's not obvious that there's a reason for that, and it's not obvious that the latent heat and sensible heat parts would break down as evenly as they do either, because latent heat in the air sea flux tends to be a much larger term. So there's a complication in the vertical transport versus the meridional transport versus that is complicated to think about. All right. I'm going to do the time. Perfect. Did I have anything else I wanted to say here? No. Okay. So if we take now rather a global view, a side view, now we can start to see where the boundary layers are in this process. So here I have drawn from the equator to the pole a little bit of ocean, a little bit of land, a little bit of continental glacier, an atmospheric boundary layer here with squiggly oranges, an ocean boundary layer with blue dashes, and an ice boundary layer, if you want, in white dashes. And so why do we care about the boundary layers in terms of this conception? That's really what I'm after here. First, I'm going to talk just from a systems perspective, and then we're going to talk about dynamics in a minute, why the dynamics of the boundary layer are different than the dynamics of the interior. So the first thing you might say is, well, where do we live? We live in the atmospheric boundary layer. We do not live in the atmosphere. We live only within 1 kilometer of the surface, pretty much, unless we're in an airplane. That's one thing. Where does life in the ocean live? Life in the ocean lives where there's light in the ocean. And light in the ocean basically doesn't make it through the ocean boundary layer, which is about 100 meters deep. That's about the penetration depth of sunlight in the ocean as well. Those are not exactly for the same reason, but that's where all the phytoplankton live, and that's the base of the ocean food chain. So from a biological perspective, the boundary layers are where the biology is. So that's good. Secondly, where does the energy go? So we have sun energy coming in and getting absorbed by things. Well, it could get absorbed by the atmosphere and re-emitted, or it could just get bounced off of clouds, and then it's not part of this conception. But if it gets absorbed by the atmosphere and then transferred to the ocean, how does that air-sea transfer of energy occur? Well, it goes through the atmospheric boundary layer and then through the ocean boundary layer. And it might go through sensible heating, with this being warm air over cold ocean, or it might go through latent heating, where this ocean is evaporated, and then there's a transfer of energy along with the transfer of water vapor. And the next piece, the piece that we didn't talk about, is why was this 1 watt per meter square out of balance? Because we've been emitting crazy greenhouse gases for 250 years, and those tend to trap this outgoing radiation. So the CO2 in the atmosphere traps the outgoing radiation, which actually warms up the planet a little, which puts more water vapor in the atmosphere, which traps even more of the outgoing long wave radiation. And so 4 watts per meter square is about what you would guess if you double the amount of CO2. We're on our way to doubling. We're not there yet. A 1 watt per meter square imbalance was what was observed.
Yeah. Do you see an increase over time?
Yes. So it's both an increase in the magnitude of the radiative effect, and also the temperature is trying to keep up with it. So that's the part I wanted to get to, is so where is the carbon that we care about? The carbon, well, we care about carbon for two reasons. We care about the carbon in the atmosphere because it's doing this part. We care about carbon in the ocean because dissolved carbon dioxide in the ocean turns into, is an acid, essentially. So ocean acidification is when the carbon ends up in the ocean. And the way that the carbon gets from the atmosphere to the ocean is through the boundary layer. Yeah?
If we would stop changing CO pump down, what is the equilibration time?
That's an excellent question. The fast time scale, the time scale that we normally talk about when we think about human impacts, is how long it takes for the ocean boundary layer to warm up and to come into equilibrium with carbon and also the present biology. The slower time scales of the system are, what if the carbon goes into the deep ocean? What if the carbon, if the energy goes into the deep ocean, warming the ocean interior, sea level rise? What if the ice melts? What if the biology changes or evolves? So the fast time scale is a matter of decades to get equilibrated. These longer, slow time scales are a matter of, decades to get equilibrated and have good enough statistics to notice the difference over all the weather variability. The slower time scales for the ocean are order 100 to 1,000 years. For the ice are 1,000 to 10,000 years. For the biology, could be seasonal, just to not grow as much or to grow more, depending on the carbon in the atmosphere, or could be evolutionary time scales, depending on how big the perturbation to the system is. So there's a very long response time, and there are plenty of irreversible pieces. We don't think that if you manage to melt all of the continental ice, it would come back if you returned the original carbon dioxide. There are tipping points in the system. So we think there are multiple equilibria in certain pieces as well. So it's not easily reversible, both by time scale and by fixed point, if you like. Okay. All right, fine. Okay, good. I think we've got, so we said we need to transport heat in the atmosphere. And we can do that in the atmosphere pretty easily because it's a heat engine. The ocean, we can't do that because we're heating and cooling all at the same pressure level. So the Carnot efficiency is zero. The ocean moves stuff because the atmosphere puts a stress, and the stress makes currents, and then the currents move around stuff, and we end up also getting a Q flux in the ocean. Okay? All right. So that's a bunch of big picture stuff. Okay. So the other reason, so that's kind of the system's reason why we care about boundary layers, is because they're controlling on these air sea fluxes and ice-ocean exchanges. All of that stuff, all of those energy exchanges, carbon exchanges, are filtered through the boundary layer. So the dynamics of the boundary layer are important. The dynamics of the boundary layer are also important for the filtering of that stress. What's the drag coefficient with that stress? How much momentum is going into the boundary layer, making waves? How often are those waves breaking and dumping the momentum down into the ocean? All that stuff are pieces that we've been talking about.
Did you say that the flow of the oceans due to the stress at the boundary layer, due to the wind going over, rather than you heat it up more at the equator than in the pole and you get a temperature difference and that drives?
Yeah, so interestingly, if you just try and heat an ocean at the surface, heat and cool at the surface, you don't drive very much circulation. You just fill up the ocean with the coldest temperature. And then you get a very thin depth response. If you want to get a full ocean response, you have to put winds together with the heating and cooling.
So rotation doesn't...
Rotation does a lot. Rotation does a lot. That's exactly what we're going to talk about next. But from that simple perspective of just heating and cooling at the surface and not worrying about anything else, you actually don't end up driving a very big circulation. You tend to just have a varying temperature boundary layer and nothing else. Okay. Very stratified as well, which is why rotation doesn't do much. Okay. So, rotation. All right, so one of the classic systems that we think about in atmosphere ocean stuff is a rotating tank, which I have schematized here. And for the physicists in the room who don't think about fluids, I've also put a Foucault pendulum on top. Okay, so if we think about a tank rotating around, there's going to be, you have to build a pressure gradient, you know, stuff is going to fly out of the middle, it's going to pile up towards the sides. And then eventually we'll come into a balance where there'll be rigid body motion, it'll solid body motion, there'll be a pressure gradient, which actually will be a parabolic surface, and then there will be a pressure gradient force N, which is providing the centripetal acceleration to keep the fluid going around and around in a circle. Similarly, the equilibrium point of our Foucault pendulum is just going to go a little bit farther. And without getting into a whole lot of the messy detail, there's a fun little exercise you can do, which I will leave as a homework problem because my time is going a little slowly, to show that if this is the surface of the water, and this is the angle of the Foucault pendulum, they fall onto similar triangles like that. So that the Foucault pendulum is perpendicular to the water surface below it. Because, essentially, if it wasn't, you'd be able to get energy by sliding more water up and down the surface. If it wasn't, if this wasn't tangent to that, it would pop back out. It wouldn't be at an energy minimum. Okay, so, let's see. We're going to collapse this a little bit. Okay, so, another nice graphical thing to think about here. Okay, so this is our equilibrium point. What if I ping that pendulum and see which way it goes? Now it's spinning around and around, but it's a little bit out of equilibrium and it's going to do something, right? So you might think that it would have the same oscillation frequency. That part of the dynamical system is underlying it. But there's another thing that it can do. It can get into a little cycle where in the inertial frame, if this is, say, our normal, that's what our equilibrium position would be. We're going around and around looking from above. So this way is the sense of rotation. If I kick it out over here, conservation of angular momentum would tell us that we would be going a little bit slower, and then we'd be going a little bit faster, like this. So we would be going a little bit faster when we were in and a little bit slower when we were out, like that. So here's the trajectory of the pendulum as the system is going around and around. So at this point, the pendulum is moving a little bit slower in the direction of rotation than the system is, than its mount is. And here it's moving a little bit faster in that direction, but it's a little bit closer in. Okay, so that's the way that a physicist would normally think about this problem. The way that a geophysicist would normally think about this problem is in the coordinate frame of the rotating system, in which case you get this. So here's the pendulum mount. Here's the center of the axis of the coordinate system. And you get an inertial oscillation. And so, epicycle, inertial oscillation, sure. So twice per day you're farther away from the axis. And twice per day you're closer in. So the frequency of this orbit, frequency, which I will call F, is twice the frequency of the system.
In the case of the pendulum, doesn't the epicycle frequency where it goes up and down depend on the length of the Foucault pendulum?
This is a small perturbation approximation, and then it comes back to that. So okay, that's an interesting point. Now here's the crazy fluid dynamics part. Underneath this, if you go through the fluid dynamics carefully, the fluid dynamics of a rotating, unstratified system like that will tell you that the fluid will not tip over. It'll stay in columns as it moves around, first of all. And secondly, those columns will also exhibit this behavior. So you get inertial oscillations in the fluid where columns of fluid are just going around in little circles. And so I don't want to go a whole lot into the GFD except to point out this is a really important new parameter that comes from the rotation of the system. Okay. In the fluid system, yes, because the system has already equilibrated its surface to the combination of the centrifugal force and the gravity. So at every location, you're already having no potential change by moving around in the system. So the oscillation magnitude is canceled out by that, essentially. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. It's actually very hard to make a lab system actually do that right. People try all the time. They try to make this by, I've seen one of the best is taking a epoxy and letting it cure while you spin the system and trying to get a nice surface of equal energy. The problem is epoxy doesn't cure at the same rate at the top and the bottom, so it tends to bend whatever you put underneath it, and then you still have to kind of manually readjust the rotation rate to get the right curvature. Okay.
Mirrors, that way.
Yeah. I mean, a mirror or the same process. You can do a satellite dish. A satellite dish is actually very nice for this process, but you have to spin it really fast, which is a little dangerous in the lab. Okay. All right. That's enough about that system. So now I want to talk a little bit about this executive toy, which is, yeah, I'm sure you've all seen this at Brookstone or something, where they've got two fluids in a box, and you tip it, and you see these beautiful slow waves moving. So there's a denser fluid and there's a lighter fluid. And if that was a free surface and it was a long wave, we would expect it to have a phase propagation speed of the square root of g times the depth of the fluid. In this two fluid interface, we actually get a slightly more complicated formula, which I've written down because I don't remember it. G rho 2 minus rho 1 over rho 2 times the harmonic mean of the different depths. H1 plus H2. Okay, so aside from this depth factor, you can see that the density difference is the thing that's controlling the speed of the wave. So as these densities get closer and closer together, the wave is going slower and slower compared to a free surface wave, which you could reconstruct here by just saying rho 1 equals 0 and H2 equals much bigger than H1. So that's an interesting system. It tells us a little bit about what's going on, that we had this constraint over here that fluid like to move in columns in a rotating system. And if you actually look at the motions that are supporting these waves, they'll be going in opposite directions. They're kind of shearing across each other in this wave. And the even more interesting system and more geophysically relevant one is to take a stratification in a deep box and put a uniform stratification kind of throughout the box and give it a special name. And so this system could have, and I guess I have a free surface still at the top. So now you can imagine that this system would have a whole superposition of vertical eigenmodes. And if they can touch the bottom and they can touch the top, they're going to behave a lot like this kind of a system. They'll be slower, and then if they have more wiggles in the vertical, they'll be slower still. If they have more wiggles in the vertical, they'll be slower still. And eventually you can get to a point where you might consider what's happening just in the interior, where you have very short wavelengths that are many, many wavelengths away from the surface and away from the interior. That system has a very peculiar behavior in its wave properties. And I will come back to it. So the quiz question is, what happens if I put a little oscillator in the middle and move it up and down? What kind of patterns of waves will come out of that? All right. Without going through a whole bunch of mass, I will try and simplify this. So, we'll skip a fun step and tell you that R f squared greater than sigma squared greater than n squared. Okay. If I put this stratified fluid in, this object, which is telling you about the density stratification, and I've cooked it up in such a way as to have it have the units of frequency, this n. Turns out the waves that appear, the waves that are excitable in that plane wave in the interior case, are bounded by that frequency. If I start spinning this table, it's bounded both by this guy and this guy. So there's a class of waves that propagate in the interior of a stratified fluid. They're limited in their frequency range. And they have one other peculiar characteristic, which I'm going to mention because it's too much fun not to. Okay, so which way should the energy go away from this? If I inject energy at one point and go up and down, where's the energy going to go? Away, right? Somehow? It turns out that there is a funny relationship. Where this angle is the relationship between the horizontal and the vertical wave numbers of that wave. And so it also has a funny relationship between frequency and n squared and f squared. And you can see that these two are consistent with this guy, by depending on what that angle works out to be. But for one given n squared and one given f squared, and one given frequency, the frequency of oscillation, there's only one angle that's going to solve this problem, where actually there's one angle in squared. So you get beams that go out in four directions like this. So that's the group velocity direction. The energy is propagating away like that. And the really fun thing is that the phase propagation is perpendicular to that. So what you see are bands of positive and negative velocity anomalies propagating this way as the energy is being carried out that way. So a really dispersive kind of fluid dynamical problem, pointing out that we have a new dimensional parameter that we should worry about. Okay, so now we've learned a little bit about rotating fluids, we've learned a little bit about stratified fluids, and we've learned a tiny amount about rotating stratified fluids. Let's think about how all this comes back into the context of our boundary layers.
Can you show that spin? So that's the spin. That's on the axis of rotation now.
Wait, sorry.
Your example here, the stratified fluid. That's like it's hanging.
Yeah, I mean, again, because of this equilibration, it doesn't matter that much. But yeah, you probably want the axis of rotation in the middle because it would wobble. It would have a large scale wobble mode if it didn't. Okay. So, but in the Earth, the axis is wherever it is, far, far away, and we're still magically getting a local projection, which plays the role of this. So this pseudo vector of twice the angular acceleration about the Earth's axis is locally projected into the local vertical, and that's what this F is. So even if you're down, your rotation axis is here, then you're over here, F is equal to 2 omega, and now I always forget which is cosine, which is sine. Cosine of latitude, which is sine of collatitude. Okay, anyway. Okay. All right. Okay, so how does turbulence work? Maybe that's the next. The next obvious thing. We've done two very simple wave problems, so let's do turbulence. Okay. So turbulence, from a physicist's perspective, goes like this. We think about the power spectrum of kinetic energy, and Kolmogorov says this is all you need to worry about. You inject some energy at large scale. It cascades down through all of these intervening scales. And it gets to a small scale where it's dissipated. And you can work out what this guy is. There's just the Kolmogorov wave number. And so you have an injection of energy, cascade down, and a dissipation of energy. So big whorls have little whorls, have littler whorls that grow on them. And so on, all the way down. This is the way it works in 3D, unstratified, non-rotating turbulence. Okay, 2D, stratified rotating turbulence. Quasi-2D, stratified rotating turbulence, doesn't behave like this. We'll get to that in a second. But I want to intuit why that would be first. So this, and it's an important relationship, because that goes like the wave number to the 5/3, comes from the assumption that the only parameters in the problem are the length scale of injection, the viscosity that does the dissipation, and the wave number that you happen to be at, the local wave number. If you put it in fluid of a finite depth, now you have a new dimensional parameter. And you could work through that and say, oh, I can make it very shallow, and then I could get 2D dynamics, which is very different from 3D dynamics. That's one kind of trivial change. But a less trivial change is to notice that we've now got F and we've got N. So we can build a new length scale out of those, which is that. So this is the depth of the fluid, and then here is a relationship between stratification and rotation rate. This is called the Rossby deformation radius. And so now, if you imagine a cascade going like this, if you're way, way, way far away from this length scale, it's not going to do anything. But if that length scale happens to intervene, 2 pi over LD, what happens? So, in the 2D fluid case, which is just sort of the shallow water version of that case, you actually get an inverse cascade of energy and a direct cascade of a different invariant, entropy. So 2D fluids, so epsilon equals the energy in time, which is, dvt 1/2 u squared, and entropy is the entropy in time, that's the source of entropy, which is 1/2 dvt of the curl of u squared. Okay, so this one still has a k to the 5/3 slope. This one has a k to the -3 slope. And this scale of injection is where the forcing is in two-dimensional flows. In rotating stratified flows, you turn out to have this same cascade dynamics, except this scale is set near this wavelength. Okay, so this is 2 pi over LD. Okay, so now we go back to our original question. We say, what's going on in all these fluids? We know a little bit about rotation. We know a little bit about stratification. Well, we know that the whole system is rotating, right? The whole planet is rotating, so everybody's rotating. That's fine. They could be rotating faster or slower. And the number we would care about is whether the velocity, how it compares to this parameter F. If it's moving really fast relative to the surface of the Earth, the rotation of the Earth doesn't matter very much. So if this is a large number, we don't care about rotation. We can just use the local terminal velocity to do everything we need to do. If it's not rotating very fast, then the rotation of the planet is going to be really, really important. Okay? So that's one piece. And then we also want to know something about this stratification parameter. And a convenient way to measure that is like this. And so this guy, so this is the stratification relative to the vertical shear. The shear in the direction of the stratification in a fluid. And this is also an important piece, so come back to that. But you can already look at this system and guess, well, we'll come back to that in a second. And then there's one important relationship between those two. Which is this, that this guy is actually equal to the product of those with some simplifications. So if this is really small, rotation is important, and we're near this length scale, this guy's got to be really big. So we have to be really stratified compared to the amount of shear we have in the problem for this guy to be big.
So these are dimensionless numbers?
These are both, everybody's dimensionless.
LD is dimensionless?
No, LD over L is dimensionless. Thank you. yeah. Okay. So, where's the stratification in this system? Where does it come from? How do we get density stratified with thinking about this forcing mechanism?
In the water, salinity could be density, salinity.
Absolutely. So salinity could be one. So we have freshwater sources when ice melts. We have evaporation. That makes it more saline. So there's definitely salinity deviations. That doesn't tell us how it's going to get down into the vertical piece. And it's really the vertical stratification we care about. Come back to that in a second. But yeah, that's a really critical point. What about in the atmosphere? Is the atmosphere stratified? Yes? No? Maybe? Yes? Why? Sorry, what? Temperature gradients, right. So there's a temperature gradient in the atmosphere. There's also a density gradient and a pressure gradient because it's an ideal gas. It's heated from below. When it rises, it expands, it cools off. So you have a temperature gradient. If you start with moist air at the surface and you do the same game, it rises, it cools, it expands, the rain comes out, you end up with a different profile, but there is still a profile. So at the tropics where all the sun's heat is coming in, that is what sets the stratification of the atmosphere. You basically have moist air at the surface. It's getting warmed by the sun. It's moist. Actually, it makes it more buoyant. It's warm. It makes it buoyant. It rises up. It follows an adiabat, essentially, as it ascends, dumps all its rain out. That sets the stratification for the atmosphere. Out here, it's more complicated, and it has to do with these guys, because it's storms that set the stratification in the extratropics, which is a little complicated.
Isn't gravity the dominant source of stratification?
Well, gravity is always there, yes. So gravity is still sorting things, but you might say, why isn't it well mixed in the vertical? We're heating from below. Why isn't it just mixing? And it is, but it's mixing and also expanding and decompressing and dumping moisture out as it does so. So there's a stratification inherent in that because of that expansion. Okay? All right. What about the ocean? Is the ocean stratified or not? Should it be? It's going to be less stratified because it's a liquid rather than a gas. So its density variations are going to be small. But it certainly is going to be more dense at the bottom than it is at the top. If it does have density variations, it's going to sort itself by gravity, essentially. So where does the densest ocean water come from?
The coldest.
The coldest, saltiest places in the world, which is right down here where sea ice is being formed. Pure water sea ice is being formed. It's rejecting salty water. It's really cold there around Antarctica. That's where it comes out. That's the coldest, relatively salty water in the world. It fills up the ocean with Antarctic bottom water, which is by far the most common type of water mass in the world. And it's about 2 degrees. So most of the ocean is filled up with this 2-degree water that came from Antarctica. Okay. The rest of it comes from warming on top or other kind of lateral intrusion processes with less cold, less dense water that's sliding in on top. Okay, so the ocean interior is stratified from that process. The atmosphere, the troposphere, is stratified from this radiation process. What about the boundary layers? What do they do? And it has a...
They mix
because of this tau. The atmosphere is dragging on the surface and getting slowed down by whatever it's dragging on. So it has an enormous shear in the boundary layer. The ocean is getting wind stress pushed on the top over relatively quiescent interior, so it's got a big shear stress. So we put those two pieces together, and we can start generating turbulence of this form. My one more schematic diagram I wanted to draw. And then we will understand a lot. If I think of the ocean surface, it's not terribly dissimilar with the atmosphere, but the ocean surface is easier for me to think about. So you have some wind stress. We would have a shear profile. And we might also have some stratification. Okay. What happens to the shear profile if I mix those vectors conservatively? Conserving momentum, I should say. Come out to be the average of the momentum. So I would get a profile that was like that, right? Something like that. Okay, now remember that the kinetic energy goes like the square of the velocity. Which one of those has more kinetic energy? The first one, right? Because this guy dominates over this guy in the kinetic energy, and you mix them up and make them the same, you've now lost a square in favor of something that's now the arithmetic mean. So we can, when we mix, we can extract kinetic energy. The kinetic energy of the flow goes down, and so it's available to drive the mixing. So if we have shear, we can drive mixing by extracting it out of a mean shear and putting it into turbulent motions. That's a source of energy for our turbulence. What about potential energy? So we have dense stuff at the bottom, light stuff at the top. What happens if we mix it up? Ends up somewhere in the middle. And actually, because of the way the seawater works, it doesn't end up actually in the middle. It ends up a little denser than the middle. But whatever. That's a weird thing about salinity and temperature that we don't have to worry about. If you end up somewhere in the middle, now what have you done to the potential energy of that system?
Decreased.
Yeah. You've lifted dense stuff up and mixed it with light stuff. So the center mass goes up in that process. So the mean potential energy goes up when you mix. Okay, we put these two together. There's got to be a balance between the amount of shear that gives us energy and the amount of stratification that we have to mix against in order to effectively generate turbulence. And we've already written that ratio here. This is the amount of energy it takes to mix, divided by the amount of shear you've got. So there will be turbulence when the Richardson number, if the Richardson number is negative, there will always be turbulence because that'll be dense stuff on top of light stuff and also shear. If the Richardson number is between 0 and 1/4, there will be enough shear that the gain in kinetic energy will exceed the cost in potential energy. And then there is the crazy regime, which turns out that there's a fancy way involving a three-dimensional instability that can extract energy even in this case. And then if you go to Richardson numbers that are greater than 1, there is a rotating stratified three-dimensional instability that can extract energy from this. But this guy is really efficient in producing turbulence. This guy is sort of efficient in producing turbulence. This guy is not very efficient in producing turbulence. This is really, really not efficient in producing turbulence. So our boundary layer process, our program, is about identifying these regimes, thinking about how rotation and stratification let us transition between the really efficient mixing that produces a lot of turbulence, deepening that mix layer, making things go fast, be well mixed in the vertical, to relatively inefficient turbulence that doesn't do that, that might just be part of this large-scale meridional transport of Q, but isn't really enough turbulence to mix vertically and to make you part of the boundary layer.
You simply use the shear to drive the turbulence.
Yes.
Doesn't the shear vanish due to viscosity, which actually ultimately basically just produces heat, and then I can't use it to drive to?
Yes, it does, but we have a stress that's continually re-injecting more momentum in and. So the wind is driving more and more shear, and that shear is going, it's mixing, it's doing that process over and over again. And that energy, this momentum is coming directly out of the energy of the sun, and the need to drive this process.
I understand that, but the actual viscosity that's responsible for disappearance, for dissipating the shear, and that dissipation goes into thermal energy, not into...
Not quite. So this is large-scale reduction of the shear by turbulent motions. Those turbulent motions make smaller turbulent motions and make smaller turbulent motions that then are dissipated by the viscosity. So this occurs, this reduction in shear occurs on macroscopic length scales, tens of meters, hundreds of meters, whereas this occurs on centimeter or millimeter scale. Does that make sense?
So it's more like Kelvin-Helmholtz.
Yeah, so this is the Kelvin-Helmholtz regime. This is the convective regime. This is the symmetric instability, centrifugal instability regime. This is the geostrophic instability regime. And the last piece, maybe, these guys each come with horizontal length scales, depending on what they are. Plume scale, overturning whole boundary layer scale. This guy is boundary layer plus a little more scale. This guy is very intimately related to this horizontal wavelength. And so these guys tend to be pancake-like in shape, which is where our weather comes from. That's where the big eddies in the ocean come from. This class of instability. This class. All right, thank you.
More questions?
How much of all this messy stuff you have to use in order to do weather forecast?
For weather forecast, all of it except this balance. So in weather forecast, you can be out of radiative balance for a while, and the system doesn't notice. So in a weather forecast, we initialize from observations, and we run forward to the chaotic.
So you have to model all this?
Yeah. All this is part of the model. And these boundary layers are the whole game. The boundary layer of the ocean is where all the inertia in the system comes. So if you don't have that part of the system, you have a hard time getting the weather right, at least in maritime climates.
How many complete models of this to larger scale are there?
To the global scale that are...
To weather forecast, including all these details, how many independent, well-developed...
Independent is the key question here. There are about 24 weather models and about 24 climate models, which have approximations to all of this that are sufficient to do either climate projections or weather forecasts. Many of them are built off the same dynamical cores and base assumptions, so they're different kind of parameter choices, but they're not really distinct models. So somewhere between, say, 3 truly distinct models and 24 in the world, and most of them have been developed by a modeling or weather forecasting center over the course of many decades, so thousands of person years of effort per model.
And what happened if we consider that there are ocean surface waves in that picture?
Waves are awesome. Yeah, so waves in this, in the best picture to think of the waves is this picture. One way to think of it is that there's a really thin layer here that's a transition layer where the waves combined with the spray, combined with the bubbles, and it's kind of a mushy layer which can store energy, can store momentum transiently as it's on the way from the atmosphere to the ocean, can also store carbon dioxide. Whether or not that layer is the controlling layer of the boundary layers up or top depends on which process and what regime you're in. The high wind speeds, that's very important for the rate of transfer from one to the other.
Maybe you said it, but there must be some other effects where two boundaries meet in a line, you know, compression against the coast, for example, the atmosphere or the ocean.
A lateral boundary this way?
Or just meeting like this. The coast, the land,
yes.
The ocean, meet in a line, or atmosphere.
Yeah, so one thing to say is that, so this image really should be 20,000 times longer than it is tall. So a lot of the action is in the vertical, but there are still interesting lateral processes. Here, at the sea ice edge, there are all kinds of interesting lateral processes. Waves are coming in, they're breaking up the sea ice. Sea ice is freezing thermodynamically. That's insulating the gas and energy exchange between the atmosphere and the ocean when it's sealed off with sea ice or not sealed off with sea ice. There are stresses on the ice that are different from the stresses on the ocean, that are different from the stresses in the atmosphere. So the poles are really interesting for lateral processes, opening and closing. The same is true for the ocean. Like the Gulf Stream is a boundary current in the lateral sense rather than the vertical sense. But that's more complicated than I can talk about today.
What we refer to as non-local transport. So we all know, you know, a storm somewhere creates long period waves, arrive here as a swell. Very non-local.
Yeah.
Right? How much of the energy dissipated is in that piece, or is it a piece that can be ignored in the models? The generation of the swell, is that just not a big term? Does it modify the local sort of approximations one would love to make?
Yes and no. On the footprint of a climate model, there's not a lot of non-local transfer because of the waves. So if you just let the waves equilibrate to growing until they start to break from overturning themselves and assume that's the state, that's an okay spot. But in every coastal area, there is a big difference between the local effect of waves, which is often from the other side of the world, and the waves that are generated locally. So it's a matter of horizontal length scale and also kind of the dramatic convergence of the wave field, which is most dramatic in a surf zone.
So isn't the structure on the surface of the ocean that extremely important in driving turbulence?
The structure on
it's not like a smooth
water. Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely.
Those variations are of order, almost the depth of the ocean. So they must be, for an astronomer, of order.
It's actually not, it's not out of order, which is interesting. So it's order meters to tens of meters, the surface deviations. Part of it goes into setting up this kind of pressure gradients. So the geostrophic flow is the part that's a balance of large-scale Coriolis force against the surface pressure gradients. That's order a few meters over the globe. And the wind stress making waves is order maybe tens of meters, which isn't...
No, but on really large scales. On large scales, it's hugely varying.
It's not in pressure versus the sea level pressure. So it varies quite a bit because the Earth is spinning, so the equator is fatter than the poles. But actually, the deviations are very, very modest from within a meter, so that the atmospheric pressure variations we see, so the atmosphere weighs one atmosphere, the pressure variations in the atmosphere about 10% of that. That's about the same as...
I think Frank's referring to the fact that if I have a current and it runs into a wall at the floor of the ocean, I have an opportunity for generating turbulence.
That's true, yeah.
Momentum transport, that's how we think the Earth rings.
This bottom boundary is important, and the ocean doesn't move much relative to the Earth because of the bottom boundary. So yes, in that sense, most of the motion of the ocean and of the atmosphere is almost in solid body rotation. That's why we go into these crazy, this crazy coordinate system, is because the inertial frame is hard to think about because the Earth spins about 5 times faster than the atmosphere moves in terms of velocity, and about 1,000 times faster than the ocean moves. So the continents are zinging around, and the ocean is barely moving versus that. But those motions are important for this heat transport.
Yeah, so regarding all those length scales, some of which are very small, how much are resolved by the dynamical core, and how much are not resolved, and how do you deal with them?
None of them are resolved. That's the simplest point. Even in our highest resolution ocean models, we are still making approximations, just barely starting to resolve this length scale. So we do not even touch the regime of three-dimensional turbulence unless we go to a very small box, order meters. And so I have a separate set of predictions about that. It turns out it fits Moore's law, at least for our climate models, pretty well. A little bit slower than Moore's law. You can project out in around the year 2200, we'll have a global ocean DNS. But it will be hard to store the data to transport one snapshot. To transfer one snapshot to today's internet would take 70 years. So we don't have, it is a massive, way bigger problem than we can do right now.
Not to mention plotting the results.
Exactly.
All right, on that note.
Yeah.